television nerds. My name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs. We have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Paul Mather. Paul was a showrunner on the iconic series Corner Gas, the most successful sitcom in Canadian history. He also ran the internationally acclaimed commercial hit Little Mosque on the Prairie. Paul co-created and co-ran the Gemini-nominated series Dan for Mayor for CTV and created and ran Men with Brooms for CBC. Outside of the sitcom format, Paul was a head writer and a supervising producer on one of Canada's highest-rated and most enduring shows, the news satire Rick Mercer Report. Since moving to the U.S., Paul has developed with CBS and was a supervising producer on NBC's The Michael J. Fox Show and on Friend Me for CBS. And now my conversation with Paul Mather. So I believe you have one of the distinctions of being one of our first international recordings.
Oh, wow. That's exciting.
I know. There may have been one other one that we actually did with somebody down the street. So you're currently in Los Angeles, and I'm guessing that you've been down there ever since you were working on Michael J. Fox Show?
Well, sort of. It's complicated. I actually came down here in 2011.
Okay.
And got an agent. And I worked on a show for CBS called Friend Me, which was a multicam that ended up never actually going to air for a lot of complicated, crazy reasons.
So did you even shoot a pilot for it?
We did 12 episodes of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It never aired. That kind of went off the map. There was a sort of there was a tragedy involved. The guy who was the showrunner, Alan Kirshenbaum, who co-created the show and was a showrunner, actually died during the course of the show.
Wow.
We were able to kind of complete production, but it was an experience.
Yeah,
and obviously a tragedy. I knew him just from working on the show, but I hadn't known him before. A lot of people that did work on the show were close to him, so it was a surreal thing to try to be in a situation where you're trying to create comedy and that kind of after that kind of an event.
Sure, it makes me so curious hearing that story. You've got this legacy piece of work of yours that exists somewhere.
Yeah.
Do you think about that? Do you think do you have copies of all the episodes at least?
I don't. It's interesting. I have. And, you know, I'm not, when I came down and got this job on this show, I wasn't show running. I was like kind of mid-level producer.
Sure.
So it's, you know, it's not my work, but I contributed to it, obviously.
Yeah.
I believe I have rough cuts to the episodes I wrote myself, and right. I've got scripts, but I've never seen complete cuts, you know.
Wow.
Yes, has them. They exist somewhere, but I've never seen them. So it is a little strange, and it's so different, of course, from Canadian TV. I was going to say the idea of creating episodes and then not airing them would be utterly alien to Canadian TV, but I guess now that, you know, I guess that has happened with, you know, unfortunately with, I'm blanking on the name of the show.
Oh, Spun Out?
Yes, Spun Out. Thank you. Yeah. I always want to say Spin City, and I know that's not it.
Yeah.
I go Spin City, and then I go Twitch City, and then I go through nine different... Yeah, so, you know, sadly that happened with Spun Out, although hopefully they'll air those someday.
I get the feeling they'll be aired. I mean, we oftentimes on the podcast, Diane always mentions the fact that because a lot of these shows at some point are touched by grant money,
yes,
that they're bound to show them somewhere. It might be on one of their siloed affiliates, but they're bound to show them somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know how that show was funded specifically, but it's almost certainly through either the Bellfund or CMF or a combination of both, and I believe both of them require the show to be aired, or Bell would have to take the loss, I guess, or repay it. I don't know what would happen, but it's a drag, of course, because I know a lot of people that were involved with that show, and I think they did good work, and it's really a crappy way to have your show taken off the air.
So when you made the jump from Canada down to LA, was it in your mind that I'm jumping down there primarily as a writer, or I want to jump into some kind of producing position as well, or is it just whatever I happen to catch because of my experience up here in Canada?
Well, I think I had a sense that I would have to come down and prove myself a little bit.
Right.
So I came down and got the agent, and at that point I'd been show running for, I'd show run four shows.
Right.
You know, and I didn't know exactly how that would be received in Canada or in the United States. I think kind of quite often, at least people in Canadian showbiz feel like that we're not respected, or that it's not going to, you know, you're not quite sure if that's going to count in the United States. And it turns out it did. Right. You know, like I was able to get an agent right away, and I was able to get a job the first time I tried. And our strategy was kind of come in at like a mid-level instead of coming in at a high level, because if you're trying to be somebody's like number two or a co-EP when they don't know you, that's going to be difficult regardless of what your body of work is or your experience. So, yeah, so the idea was to kind of start like a rung down the ladder and work my way back up. And, you know, ideally I'd love to, you know, show run down here.
For sure.
But for the meantime, I'm quite content to work on shows down here. It's been interesting.
Now, is the prompt for that jump for, and I imagine it's different for each person, but is the prompt for that jump for you a creative prompt where you think to yourself, there are things that I think I might get to exercise my creative mind over down there that I would never get to do up here? Or is it just a matter of, you know, opening up a new world and new experiences?
I guess it's more of a, I don't think it's really a creative thing, because I never really felt like, oh, I'm not going to get to do X because Canadian TV won't let me.
Right.
I don't know. I felt like I've kind of had a, like my TV career has been kind of interesting, because I, like my first TV gig was working on This Hour is 22 Minutes. But then my first sitcom gig was working on Corner Gas, and it was such a hit out of the gate.
Right.
And I ended up show running it in the second year and did that for 3 years. And since then I've done shows that have been successful and shows I've been proud of. And even shows that have gotten big numbers.
Right.
But I've always felt like if I play my cards exactly right and do as well as I can and all the stars align, I can do just as well as I've already done. Like right. There's sort of no, I kind of feel like there's nowhere right. else to go. Right.
When you start with Corner Gas as your first, like, you know, sitcom. So
yeah.
it's Corner Gas was became legendary in Canadian television. And it's hard to exceed that. It's hard to exceed yeah. legendary.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, I think like, I like the show and I'm proud of the work we did. And I, you know, I look back at the episodes and, you know, a lot of them hold up and, you know, cast was fantastic and Brent Butt's great. And yeah. Mark Farrell knows everything about comedy. And a lot of the people I worked with on that show were wonderful. So I think some people, I don't know if it is legendary or not. I mean, I think some people are like, oh, Corner Gas, that's so dumb. But I kind of feel like that's more people that haven't seen it.
Yeah.
I like to think that anyway.
Yeah.
But it's certainly, you can't argue that it was a tremendously popular show. And, you know, from that point of view, I kind of had the attitude of like, well, I probably will never get to do a show as popular as Corner Gas. I mean, I'd love that. But maybe I can do a show that's just as good or better.
Right.
And, you know, so, and we took a couple swings in it, and I did a couple other shows, and when they wrapped up, I was kind of like, well, rather than go back into development, I just feel like if you're going to try to have some sense of moving up the ladder,
right.
Going to the States was kind of the smart way to do that, and it was also something that I had always sort of wanted to do, but never had done, just because it was crazy to kind of come down here while work was kind of lining up in Canada, so...
Sure.
So that's why I came down in 2011.
So it was the first time that you went down there?
Well, I'd actually been to the, before I was a TV writer, I was an improviser and I was in a comedy troupe, but
okay.
We actually, spent quite a bit of time in LA
okay.
And came pretty close to, getting on camera. We felt, and then it kind of fell through and I got frustrated and walked away, but
right.
that's like a long time ago. So yeah, that's the first time I'd ever like approached the American TV industry at all, as a writer.
Because you hear stories from actors all the time about going down there for pilot season, you know,
yes.
getting their like 3 month or 4 month apartment down there for pilot season and then trying it out and then coming back up again and going down again next year for pilot season.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's sort of what I did. I did the same thing. I mean, the equivalent thing is staffing season. And I mean, like, I don't know if your listeners know, but unlike Canada, in the United States, all the shows pilot at roughly the same time. All the pilots get picked up at roughly the same time. So
right.
all the auditions are done for the actors, you know, roughly the same time. They're trying to hire directors all at the same time. And then before the auditions, if you go backwards, they're or after the auditions, after the shows are picked up, then they're trying to hire all the writers at the same time. So there's like a staffing season for writers and a pilot season for actors. Where, as you say, it's like a 3-month window. Canada's loosey-goosey. Things just happen all year, so right. that doesn't happen. And that's what I did. I came down for longer than 3 months. I can't remember how long I came down. It was probably closer to being back. It was like back and forth for a good 6 months, because first I had to come down and get an agent and do sure. a bunch of meetings and stuff. And if it hadn't worked out, I would have just come back. But I got the gig and ended up not bringing out my family that year, because we just couldn't do it fast enough.
Right.
And we were planning to bring them out like the second year, but then that show didn't get picked up, and I got a job in New York, and I hadn't figured on that. Like, I hadn't planned. Right. It occurred to me that there were shows in New York, right. and I couldn't figure out how to move my family to New York. So then it was another year of the family going back and forth, coming out for like, you know, like coming out for the summer. And then going back to Toronto for the winter, and me going, you know, flying from New York to Toronto as much as I could on the weekends. So that was sort of the second year. And then when that show, didn't get picked up, we were like, okay, now we're moving to LA. So it took like a little over three years to make the move.
I'm noticing, looking down the roster by my online Bible of IMDb, mm-hmm. And it kind of makes sense talking to the fact that you were doing a lot of improv earlier in your career, that you're dealing with mostly comedy in almost everything that we've got here. Is obviously you're very comfortable there. Have you hit the point now where you think to yourself you might want to stretch into something that's a bit more serious? Because I mean, it seems to me like now drama includes comedy. Every good drama show on television includes comedy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, every drama show has comedic moments.
Yeah.
But I think dramas and comedy, I'm not a huge fan of like the hour-long dramedy or whatever, you know.
Right.
Like, to me,
it's a very fine line to do it really well. It's hard.
Yeah, and I almost feel like when I look at a show like Orange is the New Black, I really like that show. I think it's great. Like, we really enjoy it. I think the next season's coming up pretty soon, and my wife can't wait to watch it. Like, I love the show, but I don't really think of that as a comedy. And
no.
I it's sort of pitched as one, or talked about as one, and has been like nominated and won awards as a comedy. And that doesn't make sense to me, because to me it's a different beast. Like, to me, that's a dramatic show that has funny moments, as you say. But I don't know. It's like saying is Daredevil a kung fu movie? It's like, well, it's got people fighting in it, but it's not a kung fu movie, because that's not what a kung fu movie is.
So kind of expanding on that then. So going back to just the comedy route, I'm curious as to, what in the time that you've been doing this, what kind of evolutions have you seen in what has become the half-hour comedy now, what we used to call the situation comedy? I mean, I grew up with the teleplay situation comedy, and I find it incredibly comfortable even when a show today still tries to minimize sets. I love the one-set comedy if it can be pulled off really well. Mm-hmm. And it seems like shows like Seinfeld blew that all open with like 20, you know, 15 and 20-second cuts.
Right.
Where do you find that some of that evolution is happening right now? Just even in the time that you've been involved, has it just become that there's so many outlets now that it's become a hybrid of everything?
I don't know. I feel like it's moving a bunch of different directions. I mean, people say, oh, the multicam is dead, but the most popular, you know, comedy on TV, one of the most popular shows on TV is Big Bang.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, there's few multicams that reach that level of popularity.
Sure.
Certainly a lot less as a percentage, you know, of than what the landscape looked like in the 80s or the 70s or something. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know that there is an evolution. I think there's trends, you know, like I think streaming cable changed things, you know, like you do have things like that are more crossover, like Orange is the New Black. If you want it, like, to me, again, I love the show. It's like, that doesn't seem like a sitcom.
No,
to me,
it's
that
not. Seems,
you know, but to me, any half hour, like, is Louie a sitcom? I don't know. You know, I don't know what that is.
Exactly.
It's a really good show. And that is a comedy.
Yeah.
And it's a comedic situation, so I guess it's a sitcom. I don't know.
It's a comedy, but it's, and I would even say that maybe it's more of a true situation comedy, but it's not necessarily, hey, we're going to crank up these jokes per minute kind of comedy.
Yeah.
It's not like we have to hit this many beats, you know, every single minute in order to have a funny thing happen. It's just a narrative, and it's awkward sometimes, it's weird sometimes, and funny maybe sometimes in the idea that it makes you feel a bit uneasy at the end of an episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, and that's an outlier show, right? Yeah. Like, I think, like, every stand-up comedian wants to do, like, a version of Louie, and I'm not sure that there's room for more of them.
Right.
I don't know, like, I've never felt like, I felt like there's multicam and there's single cam, and then there's sort of different audiences and different channels and different networks and, you know, different intentions for comedy, and there's web stuff and, you know. So there's like a million different varieties. And to me, I don't know if there's really trends or progression. I feel like there's just more variety now.
Right.
And I'm less of a, even back when we wanted to do Corner Gas, they didn't want to call it a sitcom. They wanted to call it a, what did they call it? A narrative comedy, a narrative. Yeah. I think they wanted to call it a narrative comedy. Like I always find like that. I it's a little pretentious. It's like, it's a sitcom. It's a situation comedy. That's right. Like, that's what it means. You know, I mean, I guess some people take sitcom to mean it's a multi-camera sitcom in front of a live audience. But to me, if it's a comedy show and it's not a sketch comedy show, it's a sitcom.
Right.
So I don't really know how to answer the question. Like, to me,
it's okay. We're talking around it, but I don't know that there is an answer, to be honest with you. I think it's more just talking about the idea that, that there are all these trends going on now, and I mean, I'm seeing some of the trends expand through the fact that you've got the new outlets as well, whether it's, like you say, with the example of Orange is the New Black, even though it's not a comedy, you've got Netflix entering the game, and you've got Amazon entering the game, and you've got all these new content providers that used to just repurpose material that are now creating their own material. To me, that's exciting because it opens up boundaries, because what's the use of doing something that's already being done on network television?
Yeah, well, and they have to differentiate, and it's like, you know, I mean, it's very similar. In a cable situation where, you know, people doesn't want you to feel left out, so they have to create shows where you feel like you have to get that show to you know, you have to get Game of Thrones so you can talk about it with people.
Right.
So the goal is to kind of get people signed on to the thing, and if people actually watch it, that's great, and people do watch Game of Thrones, but it's almost like a secondary consideration. Like, it's mostly you have to feel like you have it and you have access to it.
Right.
And I think that's what, you know, I mean, it seems to me that's what Netflix is trying to do, you know, and Hulu is trying to do, and Amazon is presumably trying to do, although I don't know exactly like what they're, I guess they're trying to improve their, I'm not quite sure what Amazon's model is. Like, just, it's interesting how they just go into everything.
I don't know either. I mean, they had the one show, why am I totally blanking on it now? They had the one show just over the past year that won the awards, and I'm trying to think of the actor. I'm totally blanking on the actor. Oh, it'll come back to me at some point. The guy who was on the Larry Sanders Show.
Oh yeah. No.
It was trans something or transparent. Transparent is what it was.
I'm embarrassed. I can't remember either.
But I mean, they're creating content because I think they realize the content's important. Diane and Greg talk about the fact that we wish some more Canadian networks would realize how important content was instead of just repurposing the same content over. Like, in other words, we've got all these small networks here in Canada or smaller networks that don't generate their own content. They just repurpose the parent content.
Yes. Well, this is the problem. This is a frustration. This is the problem with the Canadian industry. And I mean, it's not because the people who work at the private networks are stupid or bad or don't care, but the business model is, you know, such that the way that they make money is by airing American stuff.
Yeah.
And they're really good at coming down here and, you know, competing with each other, and they're very competitive about, you know, competing with each other to get the best stuff and line up the best thing, and figure out which shows to put on which channels to maximize their money. You know, and I know that has some value because it creates a Canadian advertising industry, which I'm sure employs people, and it supports their news organizations, which, you know, otherwise might not exist. So it all has value. But, you know, unfortunately, I think all too often the Canadian shows are seen as sort of a loss leader, that's a kind of a price to be paid, you know. And, you know, and I'm careful saying this because I'm still developing with
private
with private Canadian broadcasters, you know. But it's hard not to argue that sometimes it's seen as an obligation rather than an opportunity. And that's not necessarily by the executives that are producing it, but I think the organization as a whole.
Right.
And maybe they've correctly assessed that. You know, who am I to sit here and tell them that their best business moving forward is to make more Canadian TV because they'll make more money than if they re-air American stuff? I'm sure they know their business, and, you know, that probably is how they're going to make more money. Unfortunately, that's not very good for people who are trying to make Canadian shows.
Right.
And I question, although again, I'm not an expert, long-term, Netflix is trying to make stuff because they realize eventually the people who are making the stuff that they just license will maybe cut out the middleman and just start streaming it themselves. So Netflix has to own something to make you go to Netflix. Right. I think that's probably why Netflix is creating its own shows. You know, I want, if I was Bell or Global, I'd be worried that, you know, you might find yourself in the same situation where people aren't willing to license you stuff anymore and they just rather stream it directly. And then what are you going to do? Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. I, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I think this is all moving quickly, but at the same time, I don't see those networks going anywhere for a long time. You know, like, I think it's moving quickly, but I don't know. Some people are like, oh, the internet's going to kill X, or, you know, it's going to kill the privates, or it's going to kill broadcasting. And I've just been hearing that too long to really believe it's going to happen very quickly.
I don't know if you remember how long it took for people. They had to give people, a 15-year warning that they would have to get rid of their aerials and switch over to digital boxes?
Yeah, that's
like, everyone thought it was going to be this apocalyptic notion and it was going to happen so fast. They had to put delay after delay after delay. Television does not change quickly in any way.
Yeah, I mean, although that's an example of things moving slowly because, you know, the industry was trying to change something. I mean, this is an example of the market. Right. Like, look how fast people are switching over to streaming. I mean, when we moved down here, we cut our cable. It didn't even occur to us to get cable television.
Right.
We just stream, you know, we've got the HBO Now thing, we've got Apple TV, iTunes, and we've got Netflix. And, you know, that's more than enough TV for us to watch. So things are changing. I think there's always going to be enough people that are going to watch regular TV. Not always, but there, for the short term, for the short to midterm, there's going to be enough people watching regular TV that TV networks in Canada will be able to survive with the present model. It might become less lucrative. I don't know. I'm talking out of my hat.
No, I think there's a loud minority who talks about streaming all the time and having their choice. But you're right that the vast majority are people who just aren't even talking about it because they don't care, because they come home at night and they turn on their TV.
Yeah, you know, and it'll change, but I just think it's not going to change so fast that they just disappear. I think people are bombastic about this kind of stuff, and I've been hearing it since, you know, the 90s. Dennis McGrath and I always joke about this on Twitter that we've been hearing people like, the internet is going to smash the doors open and, you know, create all this indie content, and the gatekeepers will be down, and, you know, the man won't get to tell you what to do anymore, and you don't have to participate in the system. You'll just be able to, you know, have a direct relationship with the audience. And, I mean, that's true. You can do web content, and you can do a YouTube channel, and you can do a podcast, but none of that is really taking down broadcasting. It might chip away at it, but the existing system is still here, you know?
And I think for the most part, even kids who are growing up today, because they always say that, you know, you've got this internet generation of kids who has grown up with the internet now. But I think even they appreciate the value of a sustained narrative. And it's difficult to get, even though we have web series with 5-minute webisodes, to me, you don't entrench yourself or engross yourself in a 5-minute webisode. And there's something to be said about a sustained narrative that television and film still offer.
Yeah, I mean, we're old, right? Like, who knows what the kids like? My kids, I've got a 14-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 9-year-old. And left to their own devices, they will throw on YouTube on their iPad and watch other people playing video games and narrating it. And there's famous people who I don't know who they are, who are famous among 12 to 15-year-olds who make a lot of money. And I'm the old guy.
They're the next Ryan Seacrest, is what they.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm the old guy who doesn't understand even what that is, you know? And I think that that is a thing that will either sustain or be a fad. I don't know. But obviously, these sorts of things will exist and will chip away at people. Only have so many hours in the day to watch screens or listen to podcasts or whatever. They've only got so much free time. But I think people will, I think there will always be an audience for longer narratives, as you say. And I think the problem is that people expect a level of polish, and they expect a level of, you know, kind of professionalism and production value that requires money.
Yeah.
So you have to have a way to make money at it, which means you need a large organization behind you, probably.
Yeah.
So that means that you need something like the system that exists to create that kind of stuff, you know, unless you're going to Kickstarter stuff. But even that, it's like, I just, you know, all these things are going to exist and become options. I just don't think it's this phase shift where everything's going to become irrelevant and it's going to become this rebel thing. I think that's sort of a wish fulfillment thing. And I think it bothers me a lot, because I think a lot of times you hear it from people that haven't really tried to enter the existing industry and sort of begrudge it and are like, well, it's all going to go away.
Right.
And that's, it's like, yeah, that's because you tried to do something and it didn't work. And you're mad. Well,
and the fragmentation thing, too, beyond that, is it shouldn't be thought of as though that a web series is going to replace television. What bothers me, especially with podcasting, because I'm so entrenched into podcasting, is that people always say, oh, well, podcasting, you know, it's going to challenge radio. No, it's not, because it's not radio. I'm not trying to be radio. I don't want to be radio. I don't want to be anything like radio. But a lot of times, the only way that we can relate to a new technology or a new format or a new genre is by comparing it to what's already out there. And we shouldn't be saying that web series are going to take away from television. In fact, they may add to television.
I do think that people compete for time, right? Like, yeah. For example, I listen to way less talk radio than I used to because of podcasts. When I'm in the car, I listen to podcasts exclusively now. Right. 2 or 3 years ago, I came. And I was like, oh, I'll listen to NPR all the time. And I started off listening to NPR, but I just felt it fell away. So I'm a person now, NPR obviously still exists, radio still exists, but I'm not listening to it like I used to. So, you know, they are in competition. They're just not the same thing. And I don't know that they necessarily replace each other.
Right. For sure. Yeah. I think it's about time in the episode to do what we affectionately call the beverage update. And I haven't prepped you in advance for this, but generally what happens is, because we're actually recording a little bit earlier in the day, sometimes if I record in the evening, it's whatever beverage happens to be beside you. In the case of recording during the day, sometimes that beverage is boring. So if you wish to pick a beverage that you may be drinking later on, then that is acceptable as well. We take this from a regular podcast. So even though I'm not drinking it now, right beside me, I just picked up, I'm a big bourbon fan. And and I just picked up a bottle at the LCBO up here in Ontario of Old Grandad.
Oh.
It's a Jim Beam product. I don't think it's necessarily, I don't think it's what you would call completely high-end bourbon, but the label is bright orange and it smacks of bourbony goodness. So
nice.
So I will be enjoying a shot of Old Grandad later. And if you don't have anything thrilling besides, you can certainly invent something. But if you do, let's hear what your beverage update is.
Well, I was drinking a glass of water, which isn't very exciting. Yeah. Probably later I will be drinking, I'm into IPAs, beer. So I'd probably drink Lagunitas, which is an IPA they have down here.
Are you a hoppy guy?
It's a hoppy beer, yeah. I like hoppy beer. I jump around a little bit, but it's been IPAs for about 3 or 4 years now, so... that's what I'll be drinking.
It takes me about halfway through a hoppy beer, but like the first time I drink the hoppy beer, I'm like, oh God, why am I drinking this hoppy beer? And then about halfway through, oh yeah, I like the hoppy beer.
Yeah, it's funny. Like I drink a Pilsner on it, drinking 7-Up. I'm like, oh, this is too sweet.
Yeah. I'm trying to frame this. When I'm going back over, it was funny because we talked with Freddie Wanick about 6 weeks ago or so on the podcast.
He's so great.
He's awesome. Yeah. And he was talking about the fact he was definitely expressing a bit of frustration when he spoke to us, and it came out in the podcast over the fact that over the span of 5 years, the shows that he kind of cut his teeth on, like Corner Gas, like Dan Vermeer, which you were involved in as well, even they don't seem to be around anymore, even over a short span of 5 years. Is this something where, and Diane and I also notice up here that we've got this prevalence of, you know, the ongoing Canadian versions of American reality shows. Mm-hmm. I'm finding it harder and harder to find the half-hour comedy that is sustaining these days. And you were talking about the fact that, you know, Big Bang Theory is the exception to the rule down there.
What's, well, for multicam.
Yeah. For multicam, yeah. Do you see that there's... Do you see that there needs to be some kind of watershed moment for sitcoms and or not, if not sitcoms, then comedies again? Because it seems like a lot of people who are jumping over to streaming aren't watching comedies necessarily. Like you said, Orange is the New Black isn't a comedy. I'm wondering if it's, do networks have to become a bit more bold? We've talked about on TVA a lot of times before that it seems like Canadian shows are worried about failing more than they are about succeeding.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I wonder how much that is true. Like, I would, from my experience on the inside of it, which
and
is
not at the creative level by any means. I'm talking about at the upper level.
No, but even like my guess of like my experience with executives and stuff. Like, I don't know that. I think that might be sort of us. That, you know, Canadians have this fear that about our national psyche. You know, so it's like, oh, we're not bold enough, or you know what I mean? So, I mean, Canadian TV may be falling short in terms of boldness. And I know there's a lot of people that feel, especially, I guess, on the drama side, I've heard from drama writers that they feel like there's too many procedurals or whatever, mm-hmm. or, you know, we're not moving down the bold direction or creating kind of cutting edge stuff. And I understand that. There's sort of two different questions. Like, one is Canadian TV, does Canadian TV need a watershed moment to recreate the Canadian sitcom? By, you know, by pushing the envelope. And then the other question is, does streaming TV, do people don't watch comedies on streaming platforms as much as drama, because maybe comedies haven't kept up? And I think those are two interesting questions. Sure. But they're actually separate, right?
Sure.
Like on the streaming side, I think that's completely true. Like, I think it's exciting. Because I think in the next couple of years, we're going to see people figure out how to do sitcoms for a streaming first environment. And I think that will necessarily change sitcoms in ways that we can't predict right now.
Right.
And maybe the answer is that it becomes like Orange is the New Black. But I think we might see traditional half hour, and they don't necessarily have to be half hour, but, you know, in that kind of vein, sitcoms that are more recognizably comedies that will be different from what we're used to on cable or broadcast. Right. I think that's really cool.
Do you think we see more comedies with an arc to them, which goes against, which to me would be great, but goes against so many decades of you have to have the characters always be as flawed as they were in the first season?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think so. That might be one way to do it, right? Because, the difference is when you're creating something for a platform like Netflix, then people are either going to stop watching your show, or they're going to watch them all in order.
Yeah.
So you don't have to worry about somebody missed last week, right? And this is huge. And I mean, you know, that's just like, it sounds like a very banal, simple thing to say, but if you follow through the consequences of that, that means that you can serialize quite a bit. You can serialize a lot, and you can't do it on broadcast because people might miss an episode. So that's going to necessarily change the genre. You know, I mean, I think we're starting to see, like, they redid a season of Arrested Development for Netflix, and Mitch Hurwitz put it all out of order because I think that was an experiment, and I think he likes to do things that push the envelope and push the audience and kind of go against people's expectations. And it's something you couldn't do on broadcast TV. But I think that, you know, Arrested Development was a show that obviously predates streaming. So, like, I'm curious to see what will be the thing that hits, that's the house of cards of comedy.
Right.
And I don't think we've hit it yet, but I bet we will in the next couple of years. I'd love to, like, be on that show.
Sure.
But we'll see. So that's on the streaming side. And maybe it's serialized. Maybe it's more... I can't tell you.
Yeah. I always make the comparison of the fact that even though you watch shows and you get invested in comedies, that you almost want to see them... You want to see all the comedy and all the humor stay alive at the same level. And the easiest way to do that has been to not only keep the characters flawed, but maybe even make them more flawed. I always use, like, and this is the extreme case, but the Homer Simpson case.
Yeah, sure.
Homer Simpson is dumber today than he's ever been.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no, he's like dumber than a dog now. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a sort of natural thing because you're kind of one-upping what came before. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, talking about Dan Vermeer, what was interesting about that show is we came off Corner Gas, which was very much reset the chess table. Let's move the pieces back to where they were, and let's create a new chess game, and then reset the chess table. And it was like Commedia dell'arte. Nobody changed over the course of the show.
Right.
I like that. There's a discipline to that that I think is interesting and cool, but we wanted to do something else. So we set out to do a show that was completely serialized. You know, it started with Dan blabbing to his girlfriend that he was going to run for mayor, his ex-girlfriend, that he was going to run for mayor because he had nothing else in his life, and he didn't want to say that he had nothing else in his life. And the first season ended with election night. And in the interim, the idea was we want to create, like, it's like The Wire,
right.
but funny and really, really low stakes. Yeah. But there's all these narratives that are happening, and there's all this sort of intrigue, and the idea of kind of looking at these two or three campaigns in like a kind of smaller city where it's all such low stakes, but the people involved think it's really high stakes, seemed fun. Now, I think that's a show that would have worked really well on streaming and would have found an audience easier than trying to take that same thing and put it on CTV and tell everyone, hey, if you like Corner Gas, you like this, because it's a very different show. And you know, we had to put it previously on in some episodes, and it was just a very different show from what people were expecting. I think it was a very different show from perhaps the way they advertised it. Although they gave us a lot of press, so I can't complain too much.
Sure.
I can complain endlessly, but yeah. I ought not to. But anyway, so that's an example of, that's an example of a show that maybe would have done better in a streaming world.
Right.
And I know part of the reason we had for creating that show is because we just started binge watching. Kevin White and I were talking about, like, we were binge watching stuff on DVD because you used to have the DVD sets and you'd sit and binge watch it. And we were trying to kind of create a bingeable show.
Right. That's become the new adjective of the day, I believe.
Yeah.
Bingeable.
Yes. So anyway, that's streaming. On the Canadian side, like, I don't know. I feel like, I don't know what executives are necessarily thinking. Like, I can't see into their minds, and I haven't been up there for 3 years. So, right. You know, I don't know what's going on well now as well as people who are up there currently. But I feel like, I don't know if it's a question of people not being bold enough. I think we're not taking, we just aren't creating enough stuff. There's just not enough swings at bat. Like, you know, we think of shows that are, you know, we talk about like Louie or Orange is the New Black or whatever. There are a lot of shows on TV. There are a lot of shows being made down here. And a lot of them are sort of more down the middle conventional shows. Mm-hmm. And you need, how many of those do you need before you can support these kind of outliers, you know? You know, and I know we are doing shows in Canada, like Michael Tuesdays and Thursdays is coming back, and I think that's perceived as being a sort of more edgy, pushing the boundaries kind of show. So they're there. I think sometimes and it's interesting. I mean, I've thought about this a lot. Like, I think it depends what you think Canadian TV is. If Canadian TV is like a market driven thing, then what we would expect is that we're going to have a bunch of sort of populist shows, and then we're going to have like kind of the kind of artsy fartsy high quality golden age of TV shows, but there's going to be less of them.
Right.
Now I don't know how that works because there's so few shows that the golden age of TV shows just sort of disappear. Or is Canadian TV a cultural thing? It is government supported or indirectly. Should we be curating it and saying the market might want dumb comedies or kind of lowbrow procedurals or middle of the road procedurals that a lot of people might like, but that's not what we're going to do. We're going to do stuff that is edgy and is creating a Canadian style of TV, and that people who are, you know, educated and write newspaper columns and talk on podcasts like that kind of TV, even though there's less of us, you know? And I always go back to like, when people look down their nose at Murdoch Mysteries. It's like every show last time I looked, it pulls amazing numbers.
Yeah.
And a lot of people like that show. And, and it's a good show. I don't watch it regularly, but it's not like an edgy show. But is it, everything has to be edgy to be good? I bristle at that a little bit. So I don't know. I That's sort of my take on that.
It seems like,
and I've never worked on an edgy show. That's right. The other thing. Like everything I've done is, you know, as much as people watched Corner Gas, I don't think the intelligentsia goes, "Oh, Corner Gas, that's good." They're like, "That's so stupid. I can't believe people watch that." You know, so I've got a chip on my shoulder.
It seems like people have drawn a hard line between populist and a show that's buzzworthy.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there needs to be a hard line there. I think that there's a possibility for both, and I think you're finding it now. But I guess it's really coming down to how much can you distinguish your show before you distinguish it out of anybody watching it.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I think it's just these things have smaller audiences, you know, and I think CBC, you know, has made some attempts to do sort of more cable-y type stuff, but then you pull kind of cable-y type audiences in spite of the quality of the thing, and that's hard to justify, especially with CBC. Now, you might go, well, CBC, that's your mandate, so it doesn't matter, nobody's going to watch, and you're moving into kind of a PBS kind of model. Yeah. Maybe that's the way to go. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, but, it's hard to say. But I mean, with all the critical acclaim in the world, if you can't draw viewers, the show's not going to last.
Yeah. Or it will if they decide, well, we're just going to do this and nobody's going to watch, but it's going to make people feel good because their tax money is going to produce something that is internationally acclaimed and critically received.
Right.
I mean, maybe that's fine. You know, I don't know. I know that that's a school of thought within CBC, or was when I was working there. You know, there was a school of thought of, do we do populist stuff and try to justify ourselves by getting large audiences? Or do we do stuff that's critically acclaimed and people will just sort of feel good that it's being produced?
Right.
And I've always hoped that they would do the more populist stuff, but that's in my own self-interest because that's the kind of TV I make.
I'm wondering if, before we wrap up, you can maybe give us a couple of anecdotes on the difference between working on the Canadian comedies that you've worked on and then walking onto a show like the Michael J. Fox show, and the difference between the U.S. network and the Canadian show experience.
You know, it's less than you would think. I mean, it's interesting. It's the same sort of types of people. I find that there are more people working in the United States, so the amount of high quality people is more, but the quality of the people isn't higher. What I mean is, like, there's more people who are very, very good at what they do, but the people who are very, very good at what they do aren't better than the people in Canada who are very, very good at what they do. The job is more or less the same. There's a little bit more time. And it's weird because you're shooting in Central Park with Michael J. Fox and there's paparazzi taking pictures, you know, as opposed to shooting in Winnipeg in the winter and, you know.
Or shooting in my hometown of Hamilton and someone's giving you the finger as they drive down the street.
Yeah, exactly. So that's interesting. And it's interesting hanging out with people that, you know, have worked on, you know, other big shows. I've worked now with people who've worked on Community and other shows like that I really admire. So it's superficially different, but at the end of the day, it's really very, very similar. If anything, I would say that Canadian TV is harder because you're trying to do the same job with less time for less money and with a smaller staff.
So as a writer, is it a bit more liberating having those resources at your disposal to be able to say, I want to write an episode where we are out in the middle of Central Park, as opposed to, we're going to be in some fake park, fake Central Park, somewhere in the middle of who knows where?
I guess a little bit. Like, it's interesting to see them, you know, that we did a couple split crews and stuff like that, where they would just bring in like a secondary crew to like and shoot two scenes at once with two different sets of actors. And that's not something you would ever do in Canada, at least no show that I've ever been on. Maybe the big dramas do that. So it was interesting to have that flexibility. But to be honest, I can't really think of a time in Canada where I wanted to do something and couldn't pull it off.
Right.
You know? And to me, that's actually sort of the fun of show running, is figuring out how do we work with the AD and, you know, schedule things so that you're able to accomplish stuff. And I'm actually sort of proud when I look back at my shows at the stuff that we're able to pull off for not very much money. So that doesn't really bug me. It's interesting. It's just, as you say, it's just the potential is higher. It's like the potential, you know, the potential is so much, this is the center of the world's entertainment industry, and you know, anything that could be produced, as hot, as popular as what a show can be on the planet Earth, you could potentially be involved with that show,
right?
If you're out here,
like the failures are noticed more and the successes are noticed more.
Well, that's the other thing I've had. Yeah. I mean, that's something that's frustrated me about Canadian TV is I did a show called Men with Brooms, and I think we were reviewed twice.
Yeah.
Like, I think we got picked up. I think we were reviewed twice. I did shows at the Edmonton Fringe when I was in high school that would get reviewed 4 or 5 times by different reviewers for different papers. It's like the amount of feedback, it's a little bit sad. And that's sort of I have a chip on my shoulder about that too. It bothers me sometimes that we support our Canadian bands, for example, like, right. You know, if you're in a band from Toronto and you're making a bunch of, you're making a bunch of musical albums, people kind of rally behind you a little bit and they're like, well, we'll go out and support that. At least, you know, even like independent papers and stuff will like have someone covering that beat.
Right.
But if you're making a TV show in the same city, they'll like completely ignore you and if anything, talk trash. Now, maybe that's because we're not making stuff that's cool or alternative enough or doesn't have the right cultural signifier to make people feel like it's part of their scene. But at the end of the day, it's still, if your mandate's to cover the culture that's happening around you, then I think it behooves you to kind of pay attention to that stuff, even if it's to say that you don't like it. You know, that's why I think what you guys are doing with TVA is so great, because it's necessary, and it's a little insulting, I think, when it's not there, you know.
At some point you need a megaphone, as small as as our megaphone might be. You need a megaphone to just shout out and say this exists.
Yeah, and a criticism too. You know, like it's frustrating to create something and sort of, not that you're dropping it into the, you know, down a well and you're never hearing back, because you hear from people whether they like it or not, and sure. You find out, you know, what the ratings were and stuff. But here, you do a show and every episode gets a write-up somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, every episode gets like a 800, 400, 500 word review. So it's at least from a being into yourself point of view and thinking of it yourself, it's more fun.
So what kind of projects do you have coming up on the horizon? I have to imagine, what did you call it? Did you call it staffing season? I forget what
you
called
it. Yeah, staffing. I think staffing is what they call what writers do.
Yeah.
And pilot season is what they call what actors do. Yeah, I just actually got a gig on a new show called Cooper Barrett's Guide to Surviving Life. I think they might have just called it Guide to Surviving Life. I got hired like yesterday, so I haven't started yet. But it's
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. It's a show on Fox, and I'm super pumped. It's the pilot's really, really good, and there's the people I'm going to be working with are like really exciting, high quality people. So I'm looking forward to that. So that's what I'm doing, but I have not started yet.
Yes, it's listed on the Fox website as The Guide to Surviving Life.
Yes, I've seen it both ways. I don't even know the name of the show, so that's how informed I am. And
apparently,
yet somehow they
have their own Instagram account, so that's good.
They do have an Instagram account.
Apparently.
They're promoting your show. It's an interesting idea.
That's very cool. You kind of mentioned earlier, is it a matter of still the life of somebody who's a writer or producer, just kind of always have like 50 different ideas in the back of your head, and whichever ones you think you can, you know, launch in this direction or this direction, whether it's back north of the border or down there? Is it always just kind of open season on ideas?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, if I'm not like working, then I'm ideally I should be developing. And I've got stuff in development in Canada right now, and I will pitch stuff. I've had stuff in development in the U.S. too, and you know, I'll continue to pitch on both sides of the border. You know, I'd love to show run again, and I think if there's a project that you know, that works in Canada that wouldn't work in the U.S. for whatever reason, and it's a cool project, then I would come back and work on that.
Well, thanks to Paul Mather for talking to me about his life in television north and south of the 49th parallel. Yeah, that's right. We got to hear about stories from LA, from New York, from Canada. If he had done a series in Mexico, we would have the full NAFTA treatment here on the TV ABC's podcast this week. Thanks so much to him for coming on and talking with us about his experience in not only Canadian television, but U.S. television as well. You can find this podcast, all of the past episodes, by going to tv-eh.com, clicking on podcasts, and just scrolling down and listening to as many as you'd like. We've got some great past ones there that you can go listen to. If you'd like to support the show financially, even if it's just to the tune of a buck an episode, please go to our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/TV_EH. You can find the TVA account on Twitter at TV_EH. You can find all the other podcasts that I do at anthonymarco.com. You can find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco, and feel free to leave a comment either under this podcast when you see the post, or hit us up on Twitter and let us know what you think. We love bringing this show to you every couple weeks, and we will continue to do so, and we will welcome all recommendations and suggestions. And that wraps up another show for this week, and now back to your regularly scheduled programming.